So this is kind of a reflective talk like Roger's, and I don't know how many of the requirements for that I meet. At first, I'm supposed to be old, and I'm reminded of the scene in the Holy Grail. Old woman! Man, sorry. I'm 37! What? I'm 37, I'm not old! All right, well, I'm 38. But doesn't hold entirely. But the other thing is, in terms of a measure of success, well, I have no T-shirt. Okay, so you know, I have something to strive for. What I'm going to do, though, nevertheless, is share just some of my experiences and see what we could maybe generalize from it. And you wonder, if I'm talking about my own life and my own experiences, why do I need a piece of paper? It's not that I can't remember these things. It's just that, heaven forbid, I should leave something out, right? So I've got it all the things that I want to hit on. Well, first part what I want to do is just go through a few titles and just some of the things that happened as a result of them for me. And Joe mentions that I had done some scholarly writing, which is a polite way of saying that I wrote books that no one purchased. But that started to change a little bit in 2004. I had this book called The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, and that sold really well. I think in large part because the title is just so compelling, and I wish I could take credit for that title, but I'm the worst title guy in history. So I would never have thought of a brilliant title like that. That was the publisher's idea. They came to me with this idea and said, we want somebody to write a book with this title. Would you do it? And I almost said, no, I'm just too busy. And I would have been like one of those record companies that told the Beatles, you know, groups with guitars are on their way out, so we're not going to sign you. I mean, because if I hadn't done this, it would have just been horrendous, right? This was a great opportunity for me. So I did this, and it was really easy to do because I pretty much sat down and I just wrote the sort of things that I was already saying in the classroom anyway. Now, it turns out, though, that I was naive when I thought, and I did think this, that sure, I'm going to be saying some controversial things, but if I say them sincerely, then people, if they can't agree with me, they'll at least respect my position, and we can have an honorable difference of opinion. And there's a teensy-weensy sense in which it didn't turn out that way. Now, for example, the book came out in late 2004. By January of 2005, the New York Times was writing about it. So you think, oh, I got a review in the New York Times. Not quite. I got a denunciation on the editorial page, not the book review section. So I was just that dangerous, a little geek, that I had to be on the editorial page denounced. So what was the nature of the denunciation? I mean, like, what was my big crime? What terrible things had I done? And the hilarious aspect of this little write-up was that they did not say, now Woods says such and such, and the reason this is wrong is da-da-da-da-da. No, it was sufficient to say, he says this. Isn't that unbelievable, the nerve of this guy? And then he also says that. It's astonishing that he would say this. And I felt kind of, you know, uncowed. I hadn't actually said anything wrong. Like, for example, can you believe he thinks the Marshall Plan was not really a central factor in the European recovery after World War II? And that was it. Like, there was no argument. There was no, just, that was, can you believe he said it? This is the sort of thought control apparatus that we have in the media, that we're not going to bother refuting you. Because the very fact that we're attacking you already proves you're a crank. And as a crank, you don't deserve a refutation. We don't have the time. We're too busy, you know, making up propaganda for wars to have time to refute you. So I didn't get any refutation, or I actually said that I didn't think Franklin Roosevelt had done anything to get the country out of the Great Depression. Again, no attempt to refute this. Just, they couldn't believe I had said it. So the whole review, such as it is, went that way. And I thought, well, this is kind of too bad. You know, I mean, I guess my view that I'll just be treated nicely and so on doesn't seem to be panning out. But it turns out that sales of the book really spiked after that. Because the average person thought, I don't know why the New York Times is so angry about this, but I have got to find out. So it was like I had won the Pulitzer Prize or something. It was the best thing that could have happened. And so what they've done in the future ever since then is I have a book come out, they just say nothing about it at all. But that book actually became a New York Times bestseller for 12 weeks. And that was partially because, you know, the New York Times strategy against it backfired, but also because I got some media for the book. And this is a theme I'm going to get to later about how do you get your message out there. My publisher of this book, Regnery, is very plugged into sort of very traditional right-wing outlets. They're not really plugged into my traditional outlets, but I could always sort of reach those people already. But they could get me on to, you know, talking to Sean Hannity. And back in 2004, Hannity was on a program on Fox News called Hannity and Combs. And it turns out Combs is actually a much more genial guy than Hannity. I mean, very, you know, I had been on TV before, but this is like the first giant audience I've been on. I step on the set during the commercial break, and Combs is, you know, striking up a conversation. Oh, your book looks very interesting. Very glad to have you. And Hannity is like the Iceman. Like, you know, I'm just, look, this is my job. I'm not going to do any more than is absolutely necessary. I'm not going to talk to anybody. Look, I don't care. I just want to sell some books and get out. But just before we went on, we had 5 seconds, and he said, how's your book selling? I said, oh, pretty well. All right, so that, look, fair enough. All right. So then the thing starts going, and it turns to, we start talking about the Great Depression. Hannity has never heard the argument that the interventions in the 1930s may have caused the Depression to drag on longer than otherwise. He's never heard this before. He said, wow, actually, I've never heard that. Now, here he is, like one of the top five right-wing media personalities. Never even heard, not that he doesn't know the details, never even heard the claim. So then, well, okay, that's an interesting thing to learn. But then the rest of the interview really was Combs and I going at each other, you know, arguing back and forth. And it turns out that that's the best thing you can ask for. You, ideally, you don't want just softballs thrown at you. That makes for boring television. But when you're engaging them and going back and forth, that makes interesting television. It makes people buy the book, as I found out later. And at the time, I thought, gee, I wish they were being, you know, just throwing me the softballs. No, that was wrong. I shouldn't have wanted that. But it was just this weird thing that now I was some, I had been some, you know, little kid with his dinky books that nobody bought, and now suddenly I had this thing. And I will, I'm going to tell you something that other authors will deny, but they're lying. You do actually watch your Amazon sales rank. I mean, that's just absolutely unavoidable. You do watch it. They're lying if they tell you. I know other authors have sold a lot, and that's the first thing they do in the morning is see how it's doing on Amazon. I don't do that anymore because after a while it just levels off. But it was, I remember the morning after I did Hannity and Combs, it was at, oh, I don't know, I think it was at like number 21. And that includes fiction and cookbooks and things that I can't possibly compete with. And then later after I did Fox and Friends the next morning, it was going up to like number 10. And then I didn't get to see it because this is before smartphones and I was on the train, but it hit number 6. And again, oh, this is overall just incredible. Like, I never expected something like this to happen. Now, of course, there were attacks on me, but I'm not going to waste your time with that. But I kept on because I've done, believe me, on my website, I got all the replies to that. And I think I got the better of some of them. But anyway, so I sort of continued this and I had this book, 33 Questions, a few years later, continuing on American history, I think is a better book, actually. And there I continue to talk about, you know, themes that I felt like were left out or distorted in the typical textbook, or just things that I wished I had known when I was younger so that I wouldn't have had to spend all this time finding it out for myself. Like, for example, my father was a Teamster. So he was a union guy his whole life, but he had this funny feeling that unions were probably antisocial institutions, but he couldn't quite put his finger on the whole theory. So I took it into my own hands with my false consciousness, denouncing unions as a blue-collar son. And, you know, I got stuff on that and on the Great Depression. I'd wanted to talk about Austrian business cycle theory in the Politically Incorrect Guide, but no space. They said 80,000 words is all you get. I submitted 100,000, and I figured, well, they'll just take it, right? Well, who would turn down a free 20,000 words? They systematically sliced 20,000 words out of that book. Horrible. So it saw the light of day in 33 Questions. But the key thing, though, that for me and that helped me to learn stuff about how this all works was when Meltdown came out. Because I thought in 2008, somebody's got to write some kind of Austrian take on what's happening here. Right? I mean, this is a golden opportunity being handed to us, I was going to say on a silver platter, but then that kind of undermines the goal. But anyway, the point is it's a great super-duper opportunity. You know, like, why, we got to seize this, right? I mean, you know, you're not going to get a crisis like this that just, you know, hits you in the face all the time. You have to grab this opportunity. So my first thought was, Ron Paul needs to write a book on this because he's got credibility here, because he's been warning about it. He's got a track record of warning about it. He's knowledgeable. He's a best-selling author. He's a person who's in a position of influence. He should do it. So I actually proposed this and said, I think you would be crazy not to write a book about this. And his response was, but I've already said everything I can say. I've given speeches and we've collected the speeches. I said what I can say. I don't think there's anything more I could say. I thought, but that's what makes the book so easy, right? Because you've already said it, you put it all together and you make a book. That's how most academics make books, right? They take all their journal articles and they somehow come up with a common theme and there you go. You got a book. But he didn't want to do it. So I said, all right, well, what about if I do it? Would you write the foreword? So I sort of guilted him into doing that. And so he agreed to do that. It was very nice. But if I tell you how much time I had to write Meltdown, I don't want to tell you because then you'll think it's a complete piece of crap that couldn't possibly be worth anyone's time. But let's just say it was a really, really short amount of time because Regnery said, if you, who are, you know, not particularly well known, are going to write a book like this, and everyone else in the world is going to write a book on the economy, the only way yours is going to stand out is if it's like the first one out. That's the only way. So you've got to get this thing out there, and we will rush it out for you. The normal time between you submit the manuscript initially to the publisher and it's sitting there on a bookstore shelf is roughly a year. That's roughly how long the entire process takes. That was not the case with this book. I submitted it to them in late November, and it was on the shelves in early February. Now, in the internet age, that's horrendously slow. But in the publishing world, that's more or less unheard of. And I'll say with my nullification book, I had the idea for that book in January of 2010, and it was on the shelves in June. Like, that's the nice thing about Regnery. They don't publish that many books per year. There's a lot of major publishers who publish hundreds or thousands of titles a year, and yours gets lost in the marketing shuffle. Regnery, you know, gives watchful care to each book because they publish two dozen titles maybe per year. And so if they think one of them is particularly timely, they can rush it. And so I was very lucky to have that. So I worked on it very fast. And at that time, I hadn't realized I was going to do this. So I had auditioned for a play here when I was still living in Auburn. At the Auburn area community theater, was doing a production of The Odd Couple. And I hadn't done community theater since I was in junior high. And I said, well, this might actually be kind of fun. So I went and auditioned for it. And I got the part of Vinny, who's one of the card players and friends of Oscar and Felix. And I remember thinking, I kind of wanted to get the role of Oscar or Felix. Like, I really had wanted one of those big roles, and I was kind of disappointed not to get it. But then I thought, well, okay, I haven't done this in a while. And then the director actually said, well, we actually talked about this and thought, well, this is a young guy, and he's got all these kids, and he'd have to spend a lot of time away, and maybe this isn't the best way to have him jump back into this. And I remember thinking, yeah, but why couldn't you just give it a try? If I had had one of those roles, it would have been impossible to write Meltdown. I don't know how I did it otherwise. It was horrible. It was just it was the worst time of my whole life working on that. It was the worst. I mean, just falling asleep in front of the computer, exhausted all the time, in a crummy mood. It was terrible. And incidentally, nobody knows this, but I actually considered asking Bob to co-author it with me. And then I thought, oh, I don't know. How does co-authoring work? Is this going to be like, do we write individual chapters, or are we both writing the same? I'm already getting a headache about this, so maybe I'll do some other project with Bob in the future. And then it turned out we did a zombie video together, and so all was well. But so anyway, the interesting thing, though, about Meltdown is that it is basically taking a pretty hard-line Austrian view and Austrian business cycle theory in it, and yet it got a reception that was much better than I think it would have gotten 10 years earlier, because the ground had already been prepared by the Peter Schiffs and Ron Pauls, who speak to a popular audience. So I was able to get away with this. And also I learned that, you know, because I did a lot of radio and media, and I learned that, of course, these radio hosts, they're never talking about the Federal Reserve. This doesn't come, their listeners couldn't care less about this. In fact, there was one time Rush Limbaugh tried to talk about banking and credit and money to his audience. And he had it all wrong, but at least he was trying. And he was deluged with emails from people saying, stop talking about this boring subject. We want to know what you think about Caroline Kennedy possibly running for Senate, which is an issue of zero importance, of course, but that's what people want to listen to. So you get on there, you talk about the Fed, you can get away with a lot because the host doesn't know anything about it. The listeners haven't heard much about it. But if you portray it in terms of central planning versus the free market, well, then you're speaking their language. Aha! What is this thing, after all, that we have allowed to get out from under our radar screen? And so that made it a lot easier to talk about this, was to say, oh, gosh, you know, these people who think they can plan the economy, they're going, yeah, I know, let's stick it to them. And they don't realize what I'm getting away with on their shows. So I got to do some, again, because of Regnery, they got me on Michael Medved and Glenn Beck and Dennis Miller, and they were sympathetic to this. Because, well, okay, I'm talking about interfering with the market economy, and they know that that leads to bad consequences. Again, this sold very well, you know, New York Times and all that. So a great, great thing, but it was at the right moment. I mean, it just came out at the right time. It wouldn't have done well a few years earlier. I mean, even if there had been a crisis. But basically the Mises Institute, coupled with the efforts of Ron Paul, who, when he talks about this, people Google it and they go to the Mises Institute website, had sort of prepared the ground that suddenly there is this receptiveness to it. And when I initially proposed this idea to Regnery, I said, I think there needs to be an Austrian school book on this crisis. They initially turned it down. They said, too inside baseball. You know, we don't want to do it. I thought, oh, all right, maybe this is a dumb idea. I genuinely thought maybe this is a dumb idea. And then I thought it over. I said, no, this is not a dumb idea. So I actually wrote back to them. And said, no, I insist you rethink this. You're making a mistake. Like this has to be done. So then they came back with and said, okay, but we'll give you a really lousy advance. How about that? And I said, fine. I'm perfectly okay with the lousy advance. Let's just get the thing going. And interestingly, when it came time for foreign language translations, I think there are a couple that are in the works, but I got four. And one of them was Czech, but three of them are Asian. Japanese, Chinese, and Korean. And I don't know, I find that interesting for a number of reasons. And then finally, this most recent title of mine, and then I want to sort of draw something out of all this, is called Rollback. It's a terrible title. The packaging is terrible. The marketing is terrible. But basically, it's a book about everything, kind of. It's like everything that annoys me, I'm going to somehow try and find a theme to it and just write a book about it. So it's just everything. I mean, it's like every aspect of the regime that makes us think that if it weren't for the state, you know, we'd all be helpless, pathetic boobs, you know, drowning in poison food and you know, getting our limbs blown off by exploding consumer products and all that. And if we didn't have people watching over us, you know, we wouldn't have a good money. We wouldn't have any of these things. And I'm just so sick and tired of this that I decided, well, look, here's the best response I can possibly give. But unfortunately here, I had this problem that this sort of phenomenon of libertarians and Austrian school sympathizers, this is not something the publishing world is still quite ready to believe exists. They still don't really believe that readers in this tradition are out there. So they're still in this mode of trying to package everything as the Republicans versus the Democrats. So this book that I just described to you, which, you know, talks about the war on drugs and the foreign policy and the Federal Reserve and all these different sorts of topics, they're trying to make this into a book against Obama. I mean, like, come on, right? Like, why are you doing this to me? So in other words, it makes like libertarians think, well, this is kind of dumb. Like any idiot knows Obama's a bad president. I don't need to read some book about that. And the Tea Party people they're trying to pitch it to have never heard of me. So they're just going to buy Dick Morris's book. So in order to promote this thing, I have had to fight tooth and nail against my own publisher. I've had to fight against the title, against the packaging, against their marketing plan, and basically tell people, no, it's the exact opposite of what you think it is. So that's been a little bit annoying. All right. Now, here's what I sort of want to tell people who are interested in writing, though. And this is one of the things that I've learned after doing this. First thing, I wrote an article for Lou Rockwell a few months ago called Nobody Sells Millions of Copies. Because you always say this, wow, you must have sold, quote, millions of copies. No. Nobody sells millions of copies unless you're Glenn Beck, unless you were on Oprah. That's not a joke, by the way. I mean, unless you're on Oprah or you have your own radio talk show, you can promote that book every single day. Nobody. It does not happen. And whatever amount of books you think a best-selling book has sold, divide that by 10. I'm not joking. And that's the figure. You would be shocked at how few it takes to get on the New York Times bestseller list. People do not buy books, and they certainly don't buy nonfiction books. They just do not buy them. So, for example, the last statistic I'm familiar with is from about 2005. And in that year, Houghton Mifflin published 3,000 different books. Now, of those 3,000, how many of them sold more than 2,000 copies? About 200. Most books are complete bombs. But everybody sort of assumes that you write a book, you're a millionaire. And I'm going to write a book and I'm going to live off the royalties. I'm going to retire on the royalties. I mean, this is like the dictionary definition of delusion. This does not happen. So, you know, you do okay. But you're not going to do as well as you think. And you think, my book is different. The problem is everybody thinks his book is different. And again, the most recent statistic I know of is from about 2005. That year there were just about 200,000 different books published in that one year. How are you going to get your book out before the general public? So the answer is that now once in a while there's some quirky book that people just latch onto and there's no explaining how it did so well. That does happen. But by and large, you either need to be a celebrity or at least get a little bit of big media, like be on a big television show. And if you don't get that, it's very, very hard to do. So at this point, I don't expect to write another book ever. I mean, maybe someday 30 years from now, but first of all, I'm tired. And secondly, I feel like it's almost not worth doing. And I feel like I reproach myself for saying that because, I mean, Murray Rothbard, not that I'm comparing myself to him, but he's a model in this sense. He didn't write his books thinking, well, I'm only going to write this if it sells X number of copies. He doesn't care. He just wants to tell the truth. And to an extent, I can appreciate that. But on the other hand, it's like, you know, you produce a product that you think is pretty decent, that answers a lot of claims that your audience sort of wants answered. You know, like all the Tea Party people, they could reply to all these, you know, left-wing criticisms if they just flip through this thing. But I'm sitting here totally dependent on some TV guy having me on for 4 minutes. And if I don't get that, then that's it. I mean, that's, you know, you can use Facebook and use other things, but you're pretty much shut out. So if you're going to do this, if you're interested in writing for the general public, just bear in mind that a lot of things have to coalesce, have to come together for your book to be like a big, big seller. I mean, you need that media support. You almost certainly need some type of news hook. Because the big shows aren't going to have you on just because, hey, here's some author who's got a book. Well, there are hundreds of thousands of people who match that description. It has to be, this guy has a book on something we're talking about right now. So you got to figure out what your news hook is. And even that is necessary but not sufficient as a condition. Now, in terms of royalties, are you going to make a lot of money? Well, yeah, I mean, look, I've done well doing this, but not as well as people. I think people are looking at me thinking, you know, where are the buildings that you're going to endow with your name on them? Like, believe me, we have not done that well. But I'm going to actually tell you what you earn for royalties with a typical trade publisher. I'm not going to talk about academic publishers because I've had sad experience with them that they're even stingier. But since you're not going to sell any books with Columbia University Press anyway, that's just for your CV. That doesn't really matter. But the way it works is, the typical contract reads as follows. The first 5,000 copies of your book, you will earn 10% of the hardcover price. For the second 5,000, for 5,001 up to 10,000, you'll earn 12.5% of the cover price. And anything above that, you earn 15%. So anybody who thinks the author is making $10 a copy, I mean, the bookstores are already getting the book at 50% off, so unless the publisher doesn't want any profits, there's no way you're getting half the amount. So it's going to be like that. And then you have to figure this is going to be taxed. Although royalty income is not subject to self-employment tax, if that means something to me, being self-employed. And then if you have a literary agent, which I've had since 2006, he's going to take his chunk. So you see, it's not, you know, you're not exactly swimming in revenue. Like people say, I bought two of your books, so, you know, I hope you had a nice dinner. And I'm glad people buy my book. Like, I'm not going to make people feel silly for saying that, but I mean, like, where would I have dinner on the basis of that. But so but people think you're doing better than you're doing, right? So we try to be as generous as we can, you know, when possible. But so if you really want to do this, though, just go into it with low sales expectations, and just know that people, if it's a good book, it'll get into the right hands eventually. Your friends will help you. They'll tell people this is a book you need to read. And some people are going to read your book because they took it out of the library or they borrowed it from their friends. And I have not yet figured out a way to stop people from doing this. This can't be avoided. But it does mean that your audience is larger than the sales figures would reflect. But I've already talked about current events, hook, you're at the mercy of the media. But it is important, you know, as Mises said, we have to reach the academic audience, but also the popular audience. Now, the academic audience, a lot of you guys are focused in on that. And just are going to be advancing the school. And that's great. And I mean, we desperately need that. And I think there are some people in this room I won't mention so as not to embarrass them, but I think really have the potential to do exactly that. This is why this seminar is so wonderful. But for those of you who want to write more popular stuff or want to supplement your scholarly stuff with popular stuff, I would say that book writing might not necessarily be the best way to go about it. It can be. The fact that you have a book is more likely to get you some media attention than the fact that you have a blog. And now media attention is not an end in itself. If it were, you know, I would cheerlead all the wars and get on TV, but I refuse to do it. But the point is that the media attention does get attention for the ideas. It does get people going to websites that you managed to utter some fugitive URL, you know, domain name while you're on TV. That drives people to places they need to go. And that's very useful. But I think more useful than book writing is get a freaking blog. Start a group blog with your friends. But get one of these and get a YouTube channel. Get a camera, get a couple of decent lights, and then just sit there and do a YouTube at least weekly on something. Now you say, oh, this sounds stupid. No, it's not stupid. This is a free way to get your ideas out there. And sure, the first few videos you do, you'll have 300 views and you'll say, well, this isn't worth my time. But you just keep doing this because here we've got this free medium to promote the ideas of the Austrian school. And all you have to do is just sit there, turn a button, press a button, and start talking about why Krugman's column this week is all wrong. Or why Brad DeLong is all wrong about something. And you talk for 4 to 5 minutes, and that will get around to people who are not going to read your article. They're not going to read your book. They will never have heard of you otherwise. And this has a snowball effect. Or again, right now, in the wake of this crisis, this is the best opportunity the Austrian school has ever had. And are we really rising to the challenge here? I mean, I exclude Bob Murphy. Because, you know, Bob, like every 3 seconds, he's got 5 more articles denouncing 5 more errors. Like, it's fantastic. It's like the existence of errors is a make-work project for Bob Murphy. But I exclude Bob from this. But I want to ask, I'm going to introduce a Catholic term, which is the examination of conscience. Okay? You step back and you examine your own conduct. And you ask yourself, where have I fallen short? Where could I be better? All right, well, here's what we have to ask ourselves. How could we be promoting the Austrian school better? How could we reach that popular audience, or B, those grad students out there who need a little extra help, who need to know what is the refutation of this sort of thing or of that? We have the brain power in this room for everybody to have a YouTube channel and a blog, and to be blogging at least once a week. Everybody in here should be blogging at least once a week, because you're not going to have any problem finding some error to refute. But we need our best minds here. I mean, what opportunity are you waiting for? If not this one. If not now, when? When are we going to be a presence with all of our names out there vigorously? So I want you to pledge to yourself to do this, to do something like this. And I remember, Walter, I don't know if you'll remember this, but at Murray's memorial service, after the memorial service, I was talking about how just devastated I was when I got the news that Rothbard had died. And I felt, and I know how unbelievably arrogant this sounds, but I was just a kid. And I remember thinking to myself what Boxer said in Animal Farm. Whenever there was some obstacle, his response was, I will work harder. And here I am, some doofus grad student, but I thought, I will work. We don't have Murray anymore. I will work harder. That was my attitude. And I told that to Walter. And thankfully, he didn't laugh at me. What he said was, you know, shortly after Murray died, I went to the video rental store and got a whole bunch of movies, and I'm just going to sit and watch them. He said, I got through part, do you remember this? He said, I got through part of the first movie, and then I said to myself, what am I, some kind of a bum? What am I doing here sitting watching a stack of movies? Murray just died. We have a million things to do, errors to refute. I got to get back to work. Now, that's not to say you shouldn't watch movies. You, hey, look, you have to recharge. But that is the spirit every one of us needs, is that spirit of Walter Block. Because what are we waiting for? If not now, when? All right. Thank you.